Good afternoon. We're sitting here today with Dr. Paul Holtum, the director of the Arms Transfers Program at the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, known as SIPRI for short. Paul, thank you for coming today and agreeing to for an interview on the Global Observatory. The Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, SIPRI, is known for providing authoritative databases on global trends in international security, particularly in the area of arms transfers. How do you gather your data, and what kind of challenges do you face in doing so? Certainly this information is often not public and not necessarily willingly shared by governments concerned with secrecy.
Thank you for the first question. I think that what we've done over many years now is solely use open source material for our data. So we acknowledge that we may be underestimating in some degree, but what we try to do is that information we provide, that we're confident that it relates to actual deals or deliveries that are ongoing. So for example, we may use information from trade journals, from arms companies, we'll use reports by NGOs, UN panels of experts, official data. And what we try to do is, in cases where we're uncertain in terms of some open source materials, we try to verify and cross-reference. So we very rarely put in information for the public that we only have one source to support. So we try to triangulate across a number of independent sources, very often trying to make sure that we have information from perhaps the supplier side as well as from the recipient side. So there's actually a lot of information behind the public database where we're uncertain about the veracity of the information. So we try to be cautious.
Your data shows that in recent years, the volume of international arms transfers keeps increasing, including during the recent global financial and economic crisis, which has led to sharp contractions in other sectors. Would you go as far as to say that there may be a connection between economic instability and conflict, as measured by the demand for weaponry?
I think that on the first, one of the things that's worth stressing is that the information we provided in terms of the statistics relates to deliveries. And in some cases, these orders would have been placed before the financial crisis. So for us, it's sort of perhaps we'll see the effects further down the line. But I think that you're correct in terms of it's more than just economics that determines this, and there's also a very mixed picture across the world. So we've seen in some cases a strong correlation between states that have benefited from the oil and gas boom years and in terms of them being major recipients of conventional weapons. But there's certainly the correlation, I think, generally for MILEX and for arms transfers and the import side with regards to strong economies. There's also the fact that security is a key driver in many of these senses and in many of these areas. And that therefore, in some cases, limited budgets and resources are put into the security sector at the expense of other areas. And you see this in some of the regions that we flag up in our latest data and our report. So I think that those are some of the aspects that I think I'd flag up there in terms of the lag. And I think that also the other factor would be in terms of it may be that the procurement plans will be lower as a result of the financial crisis. And that's difficult for us to show in terms of our data. There still may be the acquisition of 20 combat aircraft, but perhaps a few years ago the intentions were to acquire 40. We see that very much with European states and especially with cooperative projects with the US, where there's been a scaling back and a readjustments there.
Where do you see the potentially destabilizing trends in arms transfers?
I think that in the report we highlight a number of sub-regions. The South Caucasus is one where I'm particularly interested and concerned with the steep increase in terms of acquisitions by Azerbaijan and also the recent rhetoric from the Armenian side to also seek to try and, if not match that, then to certainly increase their acquisitions. We also see some acquisitions of concern in East Africa, but these are perhaps not so much to do with conflict related, but to do with appropriateness. So the acquisition by Uganda of Su-30 advanced multi-role combat aircraft seems out of all proportion with the actual security needs of that country. And that's an acquisition that we think could have been better made with perhaps helicopters or something that's cheaper to maintain and to procure. We've also seen some movements from Ethiopia and Kenya, and to what extent that's related to involvement in Somalia, it's unclear, but there's also obviously in recent days the Ethiopian-Eritrean border issue. So that's another issue that we're focusing upon there. There are also some dramatic increases in North Africa with Morocco and Algeria, reactive arms acquisitions there. And I guess the interesting thing is that very much in the Algerian case, the rhetoric is about confronting Hakim, but the acquisitions that we're seeing are a much larger scale and relates, I think, to the regional rivalry with Morocco.
The key questions in arms transfers are who makes these weapons and who uses them. That is, who are the suppliers and who are the recipients? And we're particularly interested in the regional trends in this context. Could you tell us who are the main suppliers? Has the supplier landscape changed in recent years?
Sure. In terms of the suppliers, the top five have been the same for decades now. We have currently the US as the largest supplier, followed by Russia. And then at a sort of a remove, one has Germany, France, and the UK. I think in the top 10, we have currently six EU member states, and there's certainly been a strong West European presence amongst the major arms exporters for many years now. But I think there's an interesting tale to be told just outside the top 10 and the emergence of suppliers such as South Africa, South Korea, one can mention Turkey and Brazil. And I think one of the challenges also that we have with regards to our data is Israel is an anomaly in that we think it should be sort of a larger exporter than is actually reflected in our data. And I think that's sort of one of the issues that we have methodologically that leads to an underreporting and underestimate of its actual significance in terms of contributing to military capabilities in third countries.
Correspondingly, who are the main recipients and why are they buying weapons? Are there regional qualitative differences? Might there be a higher demand for small arms and light weapons in Africa relative to the greater demand for advanced and heavy weaponry in Asia and the Middle East?
For the past 5 years, 2007 to 2011, we have the five largest importers all come from Asia. That's India, South Korea, Pakistan, China and Singapore. And there I think there's a variety of factors that are driving these acquisitions with regards to Singapore and a number of Southeast Asian states, which have had dramatic increases in recent years. I think there's a modernization and an upgrading that's been taking place recently that was postponed from the late 1990s when the 97 financial crisis sort of led to a delay there. I think there's also clearly identified concerns in the maritime dimension with regards to piracy and fishing and also territorial issues that have driven sort of a large-scale naval acquisitions in this region, as well as advanced combat aircraft and maritime patrols. With regards to India and China, and one could also mention other emerging powers such as Brazil and South Africa, I think there's a degree towards a modernizing and upgrading of capabilities to be able to project power a bit further, so there's again, naval and aircraft being acquired that are more advanced than what they had previously. And I think this explains certainly the Indian drive, but also the Chinese drive of the recent period as well.
Given your research in this area, can you share with us highlights of what you consider as effective in promoting greater transparency of international arms transfers, strengthening transfers controls, and combating arms trafficking?
I guess in terms of transparency, one of the concerns that we flag up in our SIPRI yearbook every year is the decline in reporting to the UN Register. Although a lot of the major suppliers have continued to report in the recent period, we've seen a dramatic decline from a high in the 2000s of 126 states down to well below 100 now in recent years in the 70s. I think that's a concern, especially when one considers discussions in the UN with regards to an arms trade treaty. But I think that's also partly related to the issue in terms of the scope of the register, just focusing upon major conventional weapons and not small arms and light weapons, which, as you mentioned before, are a concern of particularly African countries, but also other regions such as the Americas too. I think that contributes in terms of concerns with actually the relevance of reporting, but I think further in terms of the use of that data, simply reporting for the sake of reporting, I think that there's concerns that if the information is not used, then why should one supply it? What we try to do at SIPRI is to use that data supplied to the UN Register alongside our own open source monitoring to raise questions about whether states are really living up to their export control commitments and they're interpreting their criteria in a transparent and consistent manner. And also on the procurement side, asking questions about whether what's actually being procured matches with their clearly identified security threats and concerns. And in some cases where there aren't even clearly identified threats and concerns, perhaps questions should be asked about why particular items are being procured. So I think that's on the transparency side. But also with regards to the control side, I think it fits together there. We hear very often transparency, consistency, sort of cornerstones of good export control systems. And I think this is something that's also worth flagging up and comes through quite strongly in the discussions towards an arms trade treaty. When it comes to the issue of illicit trafficking, a lot of focus is upon the role played by non-state actors, and in particular, illicit brokers. But I think also it's worth highlighting here the role of both the supplier state and the importers, making sure that they're taking into account the risks involved in particular transfers, concerns with diversion, potential red flags, sharing information, cooperating to prevent these diversions and illicit trafficking, as well as actually perhaps from the supplier side a responsibility to help ensure that there's secure stockpiles and that the concerns with diversion in country are mitigated. I think there's also concerns there with regards to the way in which, when evidence comes through that there's been diversion and perhaps a government collusion in that role, that there's a sharing of information at the international level about concerns with regards to that particular entity. We've seen this with Liberia under Charles Taylor and Eritrea in recent years, where they've had secondary sanctions introduced for their role in violating arms embargoes. And I think this is something that perhaps is worth looking into in further information, in further detail. I wouldn't be sort of saying arms embargoes on everybody, but I think that it's worth noting there are currently tools in the UN's toolbox that could be used to signal concerns and perhaps influence behaviour in a more positive manner.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you for sharing your expertise with us today.